your mind. Forgot you even had a mind, cause someone told you it's impossible to change your mind. A friend of mine made it to 25. We had a celebration, man, I'm glad that you're alive, I'm happy to see. My man, you're beating the odds. I'm with this on this day. We give thanks to God, cause everyone deserves a shot.
Hey everybody, happy Monday. This is Eric Mann, the host of Voices from the Frontline, the segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Eric Mann, and today will be a one-hour interview with discussion with Taylor Branch, the author of this monumental, important book, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65 to 68. Taylor Branch's monumental three-volume set of the life of Martin Luther King is a force to be reckoned with. The first book, Parting the Waters, which I've read, won both the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Pulitzer Prize. The second volume, Pillar of Fire, is the bridge book in the series, whereas now we're given the gift of the final volume in King's life, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68, recently released. I was fortunate enough not just to live in those years, but to have been part of the many events of the whole historical period described, beginning as a field secretary for the Congress of Racial Equality from 1964 to 65, where I worked in Harlem in the Northeast, then the Newark Community Union Project, an experiment of black and white organizers in Newark's black South and Central wards, where I was there during the urban rebellions of 1967, and 1968, where I was a campus field organizer for the Students for a Democratic Society. Just as many people my age can all remember where we were on the day John Kennedy died, I can also remember where I was on the day that Martin Luther King was killed. I was sleeping on the floor of a local community organizer's house, John Wilhelm, in New Haven, Connecticut, when we heard the news. This was followed by urban insurrections. Today I'm the director of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles, and John Wilhelm is the president of Hospitality Industries for Unite Here, a union of garment and hotel workers. Branch's three-volume biography of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., is by nature controversial. After all, besides the copious and brilliant compilation of facts, anecdotes, data, and endless inquiries into personal and institutional archives, in the end, every author must take responsibility for presenting a master narrative of a man's life, in this case, one of the most important historical figures in the 20th century. Every fact stated and how it's interpreted and weighed, every fact ignored, not included, or chosen not to be relevant, is again a political decision. And given that this the subject of the book, a famous black man who is now dead, King does not have the ability to rise from the grave and say, hey, wait a minute, Taylor, on page 3232, that may have been what I said, but not at all the context I meant to say it in. With that framing, welcome to the show, Taylor Branch, and we're fortunate to have an entire hour to just begin to scratch the surface of your impressive 776-page book, with another 200 pages of essential notes to the story. How you doing?
Thank you, Eric. I'm glad to join you.
Well, let's get right into it. Is that okay?
Sure.
My first question is that after 30 years of research, what do you think is the master narrative to describe King's life? Where does he situate himself, not just in history in general, but I want you to answer how you think you would situate him within three critical debates to start with to frame this discussion. One is philosophical, tactical, and political use of an evaluation of the nonviolence versus violence debate. And then just, you know, you're a good integrator, so hold on. Two, how do you interpret the debate between integrationism, which King is identified with, and that of black nationalism, black power, and black revolutionary thought during that period? How much do you think he was influenced by the second point of view, not just the first? And finally, which is really putting one and two together, is the primary framing of King's life, would you say, as fair as a liberal militant reformer? Does he ever cross the line to become an anti-system, anti-capitalist, anti-white majority, pro-socialist, anti-colonial revolutionary? Or those alternate interpretations just wishful thinking for those who share those beliefs.
Hmm.
So you spent 30 years with this man.
Not quite, 24.
24, okay, plenty.
Plenty, yeah, I was only planning to do three, and I got caught up in it.
Well,
I don't have the advantage. You have the advantage on the participating in the movement. I was a little young. I was just mesmerized by it growing up, in a way, I've decided that's to some degree an advantage, because if I were in the middle of it, I think it's a little hard to write from. It's a little better to write as an outsider. I felt it a little bit as a kid growing up, but wasn't in it.
Well, since I think one of the strengths of your book is that you certainly give enough information to let other people who have different perspectives see the contradictory facts. But in the end, how would you, let's just take them one at a time, maybe that's easier. I know that you begin and end with a tremendous emphasis on what you think is the importance of nonviolence. I saw King as much more ambivalent about that. But why don't you tell our listeners, you know, what your book was trying to say and how you made that interpretation?
Well, I was surprised myself by his emphasis on nonviolence toward the end of his life. It seems like there was almost kind of a slingshot toward the end, that as other groups rejected or wearied of nonviolence across the political spectrum, whites, white intellectuals, black power radicals, across the board, people outgrew or dismissed, even ridiculed nonviolence, and almost in direct proportion, King emphasized it as he became lonely. We have to remember he was not as popular, except among, you know, great masses, but in among the intellectual groups toward the end of his life, as he had been earlier, and he surprised me by how much he said at almost every speech, even to the point of repeating his nonviolence story of Lazarus and Dives from the Gospel of Luke at almost every stop. How much he emphasized nonviolence as the key both to his democratic and his spiritual hopes for reforming America across the board, that is, to make freedom real for poor people and to change the system and change everyday behavior, which is why he wound up, you know, with garbage workers in Memphis. But he did emphasize nonviolence as a key to democracy. As a key to the hope for a democracy. Naturally, this book emphasizes democracy. It begins on the Selma Bridge, you know, in a movement for the most basic thing in democracy, the right to vote, and winds up there in Memphis. You know, on your larger question of how do I put him, I would want to start off by reminding your readers, I mean, the title of the whole series is America in the King Years. It's not a biography of Martin Luther King. It says on the first page that it's not, although he is at its center, and he's at the center of a movement that I think was the key change agent in American history, coincidentally or not coincidentally, during precisely the 14 years of his short career, which ran from basically the year of the Brown decision until the year of, 1968 when he was killed. But in that period, I think the movement was reforming, remaking the United States in ways that we take for granted today. The best way I could put it is democratizing it, making the promise of democracy a little bit more real. It had always been a lot of American history is just about what, you know, do we really mean what we say about freedom? Do we really mean what we say about equal citizenship? And the incandescent and great controversies in our history have really tested that meaning, and most often race has been at the center of that contest, and here it was again. But so in that sense, I interpret King, if you're asking for one big story arc about King, I see him as a prophetic figure working in politics to to make America honest. And that in that sense, I think he served the function of a modern, the movement served the function of a modern founder in the sense that they confronted systems of oppression and subjugation and figured out ways to move them towards equal citizenship and equality. Not by any means all the way there, but certainly changed things. Ironically, as he predicted, the democratizing benefits often flowed to people outside the black community as much as they did inside.
But that's still a fairly sanguine, certainly view or incremental view of tremendous change. And let me just raise a couple of challenges to that. I mean, within your own book, the first thing is that, yes, there's no question, as you've portrayed it, that in his last talks, he is still trying to talk about nonviolence. However, he's moving towards the concept of militant nonviolence. He's moving towards the concept, as you know, of the Poor People's March in Washington, D.C. He's talking about bringing the D.C. to a halt. He's talking about so much so that he's being accused of insurrectionary nonviolence. He says he doesn't want to hurt property per se. He doesn't want to hurt people per se. But he does say he wants to literally stop the system from operating. At a time when they say, and then you do a great job of showing the Washington Post and the New York Times attacking him viciously and just saying, well, then he might as well be a Marxist revolutionary. Basically, we don't care if it's violent or nonviolent. If that's your goals, we're going to bring you down. Now, secondly, he's reaching out increasingly to the militant blacks, to the more nationalistic blacks, beginning to understand, and he's making statements in your own book that says, I'm still for nonviolence, but essentially, am I sure that this is the correct path, right? He's saying...
No, he never said that. He said, I'm still for nonviolence, but I understand why other people aren't.
Okay, fair enough. And isn't he also saying that maybe it will have to take the fight among those who believe in violence to carry this historical moment?
No, he never said that either. But he said, I could understand why many people do it. And in despair once, he said, maybe nonviolence is finished because people within his own movement were using violence. But that was a cry of despair in Memphis when he said, maybe we just have to give up and let violence take over. But that didn't mean that he thought violence would produce anything good. That just meant he was afraid. You know, that was a moment of despair that he thought his movement was past.
No, absolutely. But isn't it fair to say that one of the reasons he can say he's for it, like I can say I'm for a lot of things, but the situation when he went into Watts was challenged by so many angry black people who said, your point of view is passing us by. You can't stop the police from beating us. You can't stop the violence that's happening in Vietnam. Isn't part of his despair, because it's not just, you know, that maybe I still believe in it, but as an organizer, if this idea is no longer compelling to people, you see, you keep saying he still believes in it. I understand he still believes in it, but I read in your own book his own doubt about it as a strategy.
Perhaps you're right if you say doubt that it was still going to carry the day. I think it's pretty clear that in Memphis, one of the things that makes the I Have Seen the Promised Land speech so poignant is not that he foretold his death, which is the popular interpretation. He did that many times, all the way back to the bus boycott.
He
preached constantly about that. What was new in Memphis, if you read the whole context of that speech, was that he felt that the movement might be receding in history, that there wouldn't be another Selma and Birmingham-type breakthrough for the nonviolent movement during his lifetime. That's, you know, that because he knew he could be killed any time, and he didn't sense the same kind of, I won't say momentum, because Selma and Birmingham were both desperate. The movement, it wasn't a cakewalk. And nonviolence was plenty militant in even in the Freedom Rides.
Right, absolutely.
But there was kind of still this hope for momentum. I mean, when all the people came down to Selma and all that sort of thing, he was really in a backwater with nonviolence headed into Washington. He was hoping that because he was getting some new people, he was planning to have large new groups, American Indian groups, Hispanic groups, and believe me, that was problematic in and of itself to try to change things. But he didn't have the optimism, I will agree with you, that the movement was going to have another breakthrough in his lifetime.
Well, and let's move on to a couple of the other challenges in his life, because in each of these we're not trying to reach agreement as much as try to have a good discussion. I want to make sure I can read that terrific way you described his mountaintop speech on 758. I, later on the show, would like to read that page because it brought tears to my eyes today when I was reading it. I mean, here's a couple of things I want you to think about, which I'm sure you've thought about for 24 years. I mean, one thing is that he's a middle-class Southern preacher. In your first book, the description you have about divinity school is just incredible, the one about the pool table and Niebuhr, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Reinhold Niebuhr.
Right, Reinhold Niebuhr and the pool table. That's an, I want people to read that in terms of how much they learned about preaching, how much they learned about the art of oratory. But this is a movement in many ways led by pastors. It's a nonviolent movement at first, headed up by a famous and courageous man, a great tactician, I would say, in mass order. But one of the things that seems to be a challenge to him is the very material basis of the predominantly male, black-led preacher's church and preacher's movement. Mm-hmm. And I think you do a really good job of showing in some of these meetings the conflicts between Bevel, Hosea Williams, Jesse Jackson, Andy Young, Ralph Abernathy, and King, and a few others, trying to debate out strategy with, in many ways, their, with King, don't you think, being the unusually committed to the poor and unusually introspective member of that group, who's aware of his position in society, and I would say a pretty tormented person in terms of his own role.
I agree with everything you just said. And what was striking to me to learn over the years was how rare it was for a figure to tolerate the big, giant, headstrong egos colliding around him. You know, that's a mark of quite a leader. Most people want yes people. around, and he certainly didn't have that. He had people they really were in a crucible, and it's one of the things that makes it so sad when you see him and the movement get kind of refined down to a pious and certain prayerful forward march, and it was anything but that. They really were at one another's throats over what to do because they didn't have any of the traditional weapons in politics trying to change the power base of, you know, of a great nation.
Yeah, and I think that just for the readers, I mean, that in itself is a theme throughout in his effort as any good lead organizer to hold back, in particular, Jesse Jackson's ambitions and the efforts to break out Operation Breadbasket. Mm-hmm. I'm on the phone with Taylor Branch, where the author of Canaan's Edge, which is that correct from the Old Testament? Is that the
Yes, all three of the titles, Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge, really are taken from the Moses story in Exodus. Parting the Waters, of course, to come through the Red Sea out of Egypt. And then they thought they were going right into the promised land and instead wandered in the wilderness where they, you know, building idols and arguing with each other. And that's when they were guided only by a pillar of fire at night. And at Canaan's Edge, the final volume, just as Moses in the Bible was allowed to go up and look over from the Jordan River from a mountain, but not allowed to go into Canaan because of the movement was things had receded. Dr. King, when he got to Memphis, said that, you know, he had seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but we as a people will get there. So he wasn't allowed to get to Canaan either. He got to the edge of Canaan.
He says in your book on page 758, King paused, because I've been to the mountaintop, he declared in a trembling voice. Cheers and applause erupted. Some people jerked involuntarily to their feet and others rose like a choir. And I don't mind, he said, trailing off beneath the second and third waves of response. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. The whole building suddenly hushed. What let sounds of thunder and rain fall from the roof. But I'm not concerned about that now, said King. I just want to do God's will. There was a subdued call of yes in the crowd. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, King cried, building intensity. And I've looked over, and I have seen the promised land. His voice searched for a long beak over the word seen, then hesitated and landed with quick relief on the promised land, as though discovering a friend. He stared out over the microphones with brimming eyes and the trace of a smile. And I may not get there with you, he shouted, but I want you to know tonight, yes, that we as a people will get to the promised land. He stared all again over the claps and cries while the preachers closed towards him from behind. So I'm happy tonight, rushed King. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He broke off the quotation and stumbled sideways into a hug from Abernathy. The preachers helped him to a chair, some crying, and tumult washed through the Mason Temple. Thank you for just writing that.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing night. You know, they were having tornadoes through Memphis. A number of people were killed. It was really like the whole world was, you know, this was providential that something was happening, and that's why his crowd was so small. And of course, being King, he didn't want to go because the crowd was small, and Abernathy begged him to come, saying, there are 2,000 loyal people here, and they want to hear from you. So he went and made that speech.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, within this democracy of ours, from the outset, a secret police, the role of the secret police infiltrating him and his group, the role of, you know, and the entire East Germany fell apart upon many reasons, but one was the role of the Stasi, the secret police that had people spying upon each other. We know today that the President of the United States is now openly calling for a Stasi or a secret police to be embraced by the people of the United States. But at the time, the vindictive and coherent efforts for J. Edgar Hoover to try to defeat the concept of a black messiah, who he thought King might be, the infiltration both of his own organization. I mean, so many times you would just say, he's on the phone with Stanley Levinson, I want to get to. And, of course, you'll say, in a wiretap conversation, or he's on the phone with Andy Young, in a wiretap conversation. And the idea that there were people inside of SCLC both embezzling money and bringing information to the FBI. The fact is, you pointed out that the...
Planted agents inside SCLC.
Right.
Who were stealing money from SCLC because... You know, and this to me is a classic example of the corruption of secret police work. The informant there knew the FBI wouldn't prosecute him for stealing the money because, you know, it had been so hard for them to get a plant inside. The intelligence work was so important. So basically they just turned a blind eye to the fact that he was stealing. And it just goes to show that... When you work in the cellar, it's awfully hard in a dark cellar. It's awfully hard to control what anybody's doing, even when you're trying to do bad stuff.
Well, when I was in Corps, and this must have been 65, see if my fact is right. We were told that King had just gone in to see J. Edgar Hoover, and I believe it was over the fight over the King criticized the FBI for not defending the civil rights workers. And King was called in with J. Edgar Hoover, and the way we heard the story is that J. Edgar Hoover had tapped and wiretapped every one of King's hotel rooms, had very compromising pictures that he showed King, and that King walked out of the meeting literally shaken to realize that he had no privacy, that his personal life was on 24/7 by the FBI. Is that true? And then how does that shape his work for the next 3 years of his life, knowing that he's, in terms of his psychic ability to sustain this work, that he's permanently under police surveillance.
That's basically true. The particulars are a little more complicated.
Okay.
Only in the sense that the FBI sent him this material to prove what they had on him, and that was shocking enough. He then sought out the meeting with Hoover, and Hoover actually did not like personal conflict, and when King went in there, Hoover just talked to him for an hour about the wonderful work of the FBI, and King came out kind of shrugging, saying, "What in the world was that? They send all this terrible stuff on me. I try to go and have a truce meeting, and Hoover talks to me like I'm the, you know, the PTA." So the world is a little crazier, but it's still just as sinister. They did send him material from all of the recordings in hotel rooms with a note suggesting that he commit suicide.
Right.
So he did have to live with that for the rest of his career, and he had two reactions which were debated among his staff. Number one, he said, "I've got to try to clean up my private life because there's too much at stake," which was very hard for him. He had to have debates and disclose personal stuff to his staff. And number two, he just said, "We have to assume that everything we discuss is overheard and that the government knows, and the only thing we have going for us is that most of what we're trying to do is open anyhow. We're much more accountable than they are." And he just kept going. It was a measure of his grit.
Well, let's take a jump to 1968, which is the last year of his life. I mean, and I want to talk about Vietnam, the international, and the growing international situation.
Mm-hmm.
In 1968, I was involved in the student takeover of Columbia University and the student takeover of Harvard. 1968, the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia. 1968 was the Tet Offensive. 1968 was the Student Worker Alliance in Paris, France, in Paris, that almost came to a revolution. So we're living at revolutionary times, and in this period, starting with the Riverside speech, what year was that on Vietnam, 66?
67.
67.
Mm-hmm.
King comes out aggressively against the war, and in several things. I have a quote, I'm not sure if you use the same one, from I May Not Get There Without You, Michael Dyson's book, but King says, "We are criminals in that war," asserting that we have committed more war crimes almost than any other nation in the world, and I'm going to continue to say it. So between that, his formulation that the United States is the worst purveyor of violence in the world, which I believe was in the Riverside speech, right?
He repeated that too.
Okay. That this is moving towards a very radical critique, not just of the war, but of the society that generates it. Why don't you tell us a little about the evolution of his thinking there, and do you think that moved him in a far more radical place than he began in divinity school?
Oh, well, this is a very complex subject because he's talking to Lyndon Johnson about Vietnam through this, and you know the president's views on Vietnam are kind of a mirror part of the same story. King never supported the Vietnam War. He criticized the war before most of the rest of us realized it was going on. But Johnson essentially called him in and said, "I'm going to end the war. I don't have my heart in it." Sent him to see Arthur Goldberg at the United Nations, the ambassador. This is in 1965, the very first year that the major, although we had been fighting there for some time through advisors, but the year the first combat units were introduced. And he did back off to some degree. He always kept criticizing the war, but it didn't get big press coverage, and it took a concerted effort in 1967, and a lot of confession on his part that he retreated in his criticism of the war in the interest of a settlement, and wound up getting no settlement and getting a poisoned political climate by the war and a guilty conscience because he had been, in his view, duped by Johnson. That's the background to the Riverside speech. What's interesting about it is how comprehensive and how strong it was on colonial history, the history of Vietnam, the history of the freedom movements, our complicity in trying to restore colonialism in France, and basically just saying we had forfeited the right to call ourselves liberators there. All of that is incorporated in the Riverside Church speech, which is the one that caused people across the board, to pretty much across the board, to come down on his head, because not just the Washington Post and the New York Times said stick to foreign policy, basically saying, and the Post said he will never again be a spokesperson for his people. And I believe there by his people, they meant black people. They were, it's pretty racially tinged. You stick to black affairs. That's all we want to hear about from you. But he also got criticized by Roy Wilkins, the major civil rights leaders, for undermining the first, what in their view, the first great alliance with the White House for black people, who was appointing, you know, blacks left and right, was about to put Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. And he got it pretty much across the board. And in that sense, I don't think that he really... He thought that the peace movement was splintering and causing more harm than it was causing good. I think he despaired of pulling it together. But he certainly never changed his mind or his critique about how wrong the Vietnam War was.
Well, one way I've been reading King, you know, I mean, I'm very self-critical that at the time I was very affiliated with CORE and SNCC, and that's not what I'm critical of. I'm proud of that. But I think we didn't understand the concept of, among other things, a black united front well enough, and I think we were way too critical. I mean, I was there when in CORE and SNCC, King was seen as somewhat of an opportunist. King was very worried, people worried that, for instance, people would be working into communities for years and years and years, and then when they had their first rally, King would come in, get all the press, get all the attention, all the work that you had done, not me as a white person, but as black grassroots people had done to shape the political message, was reshaped by King. I still hold to that criticism, but with the... hopefully hindsight of youthful age, I remember James Forman saying, yeah, but we forgot how much poor black people loved Dr. Martin Luther King. We forgot how much when he came in, he brought some problems, but he also brought a national attention to our work, and how much when you would be in Mississippi and you'd be trying to introduce yourself from SNCC, they'd say, so are you with or against Dr. King? And they'd all say, oh yeah, I'm with Dr. King, because that was sort of the...
That.
Right.
Stokely was very good about that. He always was, there were, he felt there were three factions, two factions in SNCC, the kind of fight King and be like King. And he thought he invented or popularized what he called a third faction, which was use King, take advantage of the enthusiasm for it and steer your organizing in the direction you want to go. But you can't, if you're trying to organize poor black people anywhere, you can't lead with your opposition to him, because you won't get anywhere.
Right.
That's in Stokely Carmichael, who, in my view, is the you know, you're talking about big summaries here. These are things, all of, Eric, that make me cringe, because I tend to try to leave the interpretation to other people with the stories. But you can't write this book, as you rightly say, without having your own. But I think Stokely is the third most important character in this narrative in the last 3 years, because of the arc of his life from Lowndes County, Alabama, where he did the last great, in my view, nonviolent, heroic project for SNCC in the roughest, nastiest county in the United States,
yeah,
where no black person had registered in the 20th century. For which he was roundly condemned, basically, in the end, fed up with seeking the vote with nonviolence and even democracy itself in the rebellion that he proclaimed shortly after that. And to me, it's very important for people, if they want to argue about these concepts, to live with Stokely's sixth and final year of nonviolence, which is a lot more than I put in,
right.
And then see why he turned. But it's equally important to see, well, what happened after that? You know, was any political history set in motion by Black Power? You know, Dr. King and Stanley Levison are heard on those same wiretaps in the first year saying, you know, SNCC and CORE aren't going to exist very long. These groups are dying, but they're going to make a lot of noise while they die, and they're going to fool a lot of people. Now, that's either right or it's wrong, and it's right to the degree that SNCC and CORE didn't exist very long after they embraced a Black Power anti-integrationist stance. But the debate over the larger impact of that, and whether that meant you were stopping the creation of new freedom or whether it meant you were just moving on to cultural realities, you know, is a debate that should be going on still.
And we will, after we take a short break. I'll give you a little response of my thought. This is Eric Mann. We're on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. The show is called Voices from the Frontline. The voice you hear is the author, Taylor Branch, of his very important new book, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back soon. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. Our show is called Voices from the Frontlines. I'm often here with my co-hosts, Damon Ozzoli, Tammy Liu, and Manuel Criollo, flying solo today in an interview with Taylor Branch, the author of a very important new book, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68. Taylor, one historical way I see this period, which I've been spending my whole life interpreting and reinterpreting, is that many of the forms that were created were not capable of lasting more than a year or two or three or four. And what they did, each of them, was hopefully move things forward in some rather amazing ways. I mean, Malcolm never fully consolidated the Organization of African Unity, obviously was killed before having had a chance, but his contribution shaped much of the important debates. One thing I think that Michael Eric Dyson talks about, and I just can't get the quote fast enough, is that one of the issues going on that was a legitimate criticism of King's integrationism, which parenthetically, King said, I'm having second thoughts about integrating into a burning building, right, was, can you integrate Black people into white society if they do not go through a period of nation building, of culture building, of autonomy, of repairing the wounds? For instance, Dyson criticizes King for, when he went to Chicago, King, this is, being very taken aback by the, quote, dysfunctionality of the Black family, and in some way not even challenging Daniel Patrick Moynihan's very racist analysis of the Black family, where the forms of dysfunction would be quite obvious to see, but what about all the tremendous function in the face of racism and slavery, and also not putting the burden on white society? So my point is that, isn't it possible that during this whole historical period, King was playing a part, not the leading part, nor the best supporting actor, but one of the critical leads in a debate between, as you say, Stokely, I'm assuming the third person you're saying is Malcolm. And if you just take the three of them and any others you want to bring in, what if each of them had essential pieces of the puzzle that were part of a Black United Front, whether or not they were capable of holding it together themselves, and that just as CORE broke with the NAACP, broke with the Urban League, and moved things forward as SNCC did, just as SNCC could not effectively unite with the Black Panther Party or could not effectively figure out the role of whites inside it, what if all of the people were very transitory meteors that during a period in history all moved things forward, and that maybe the weakness of the period is that none of us were capable of forming the organizational synthesis that could have kept us all under one roof.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly something to that. He never said, the king himself said that he at times was behind other people in the movement. I think most notably in the freedom riots and the sit-ins. The first thing that really stood out for me about him as an adult leader, even though he was only a few years older than some of the students, and he was actually younger than James Forman of SNCC, was when the sit-ins occurred, he said, "This is a breakthrough. These kids are ahead of me. This is what I have been I've been struggling for a way to amplify my voice, and they found it." So I think there were lots of times where he felt that he wasn't the leader of the movement, and I think that there were lots of times when he felt that there was frustrated by the fact that the debate over any racial concept in that era was so distorted by images in the media. I mean, you mentioned integration, for example. Lots of people had good reason to resent the normal concept of integration, which was that black people had to fit in and make white people comfortable and fit into the white world. King very explicitly, I mean, gosh, even the I Have a Dream speech, which is, you know, one of his more apple pie speeches, the famous peroration does, you know, when all God's children, black men, white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will join hands and sing in the words of the old spiritual, free at last. And he's inviting white people into the black world, not white black people into the white world. And his view of integration was just what the word integration means, made whole. It doesn't mean that one culture is dominant above the other. It meant politically in that context that the white culture had to quit blotting out every other culture in perception. So I think all of those things were kind of stunted and distorted debates, and it was very, by the time, you know, we forget how radical it was that black groups were even part of a national debate and visible figures in intense political debate over the meaning of the political system and the direction of change. I mean, I quite frankly don't see it that much right now. We have a really stunted national discourse on options in politics and systems and the meaning of freedom and everything right now compared to what was going on between Malcolm and Stokely and Martin Luther King and even Lyndon Johnson, who quite rightly did risk the political base of future Democratic presidents by signing those two civil rights acts, and he knew he was doing it, and he did it anyway.
Well, absolutely, and there's a lot of ways we can go. We have about 12 minutes left on the name of just a concept. I mean, I think that King's understanding that it was white racism and that he was worried very much about the racism of the majority and the racism of Congress. The fact that by 64, that was with the re-election of Johnson, was the last time that white people in the South voted Democratic, and that from 68 to the present we've had, with the election of Nixon, a permanent white backlash is a whole nother discussion.
Yep.
But I want to get into a couple of things that I think are fascinating within your book. One is that, as a fairly tormented person myself, I think King may be one of the most tormented people in terms of a great man that you would ever see. I mean, the word depression, despondency, despair were permanent parts of his lexicon. I mean, you hinted at some drinking problems. I would want to say even the womanizing problems, you could say, had a certain sense of a man on the verge of thinking he was going to die every day. And then trying to find himself, trying to find within himself the great teacher, the great scholar. I mean, this is a man with a big ego and yet a tremendous inner debate. Don't you think that's pretty unusual? I with all due respect, I do not perceive that in Jesse Jackson.
You're talking about great men in history being driven, and King himself, it's interesting how many times he himself, he's always looking for comfort, and he's in some sense kind of driving himself forward. And one of the areas of comfort that he found was that he preached about how many significant people in religious and political history were driven, and how many of them had troubles in their personal life. He talked about Aquinas. He talked about St. Paul.
Right.
He talked about Martin Luther. In the modern context, it's not widely known, but he talked about Paul Tillich, the theologian. I mean, religious people can be tormented people, and so can a lot of political revolutionaries. And the fact that King felt that the movement was doing such a service, you know, he always defined this movement as about the soul of America and being for the whole country. And I think part of his depression was the fact that he looked in the eyes of these young kids who were getting their heads beaten and doing such an enormous service to the country, and then the white media was basically kind of taking it for granted or interpreting it there was so little gratitude. And he didn't have, that's what part of the debate he had with Stokely. There was no answer when Stokely told him, Dr. King, why is it that only black people are supposed to be nonviolent in America? America admires nonviolence only in black people. That's not right. Otherwise, they like James Bond and John Wayne. But, they want the reassurance that black people aren't going to be threatening and they don't deserve it. Why should the people who've been denied their freedom have to seek out sacrifice? There's no answer to that. And King kept saying, it's not fair, Stokely. It's not fair, but we're leaders for the whole country.
And he said that nonviolence is based on fundamentally the concept of a just country, that you can find its conscience. If we're wrong and this country does not have a conscience, isn't this suicidal?
Yeah.
Right.
So that's the torment in that faith, you know. And he was doing it in a time when there were still lynchings. And, people need to be reminded that if he turned on a college basketball game on the Saturday before he was killed in spring of 1968, the players would be all white.
Yeah.
He lived in a time still with lynching, still with George Wallace as governor and Lester Maddox as governor. So for him to have hope that nonviolence was going to bring about a democratic redemption, he felt that he had set some things in motion, but it was anybody's guess whether they were really going to take hold and lynching would recede as it has. But at the same time, the white backlash come in, so we've got kind of mixed results.
And a million black people in prison today.
And absolutely.
Let's talk about, really quickly, Eric Mann. We're on the phone with Taylor Branch, author of A Canaan's Edge on KPFK 90.7 FM. Let's talk about the mystical, red-baited, red Stanley Levinson. Fascinating guy. We know at one point Stanley Levinson was a member of the Communist Party. At a certain point, he left the Communist Party, perhaps. But it seems to me that he brought, and I speak as someone who is familiar and thinks well of communists, or at least some of them, he brought a strange kind of politics, it seems to me. On one hand, he was, Kennedy threatened King to disassociate formally with Levinson. On the other hand, it seems like Levinson is the only really developed strategist and tactician that King can talk to. And that comes out of the unique contribution that communist and socialist groups bring to you, which is a study of strategy and tactics versus protest and sort of tactics by the seat of your pants. So here we see, what, 5-6 years after Kennedy warned him not to hang around with Levinson, to his death, they're still on the phone, it seems like, once a week at least, and Levinson is his main advisor. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that relationship?
King said of Stanley Levinson that his judgment is one thing, but he's the only one of the people right around me that I sense doesn't want anything. That he seems kind of selfless. And in that sense, it was comforting. And again, we're going back to the tormented King needing comfort. But it was also true that Stanley Levinson, if he thought King was wrong, he would say so. It's just that he would do it without any other agenda. He'd just say, Martin, I think you're wrong. He had a tremendous amount of balance and an appreciation for what King wanted to do. And he saw the complexity in the world. He said, you know, J. Edgar Hoover hates you and the movement, and these are the reasons why, and he's doing all these terrible things. At the same time, you know, most FBI agents don't go into the FBI to sit around with earphones listening in on people's bedroom conversations. They want to solve crimes, and they actually are solving some of the first civil rights cases. So we have to recognize that. At the same time, we understand that J. Edgar Hoover's trying to undermine the entire movement. So there was a tremendous sense of balance, a tremendous sense of devotion, and you're right, a strategic experience that went back many years there that makes Stanley Levinson, to me, a truly remarkable character in history. The FBI said that he was a Smersh type agent from the Kremlin, but they wiretapped him, and the verbatim records of his wiretaps, in my view, make him one of the most noble and selfless political advisors I've ever seen. So the FBI is disproved by the words that they intercepted with their own wiretaps.
Well, but in the last 4 minutes, let's not forget Coretta Scott King, and it seems to me at least on the surface, what a tragic relationship. There clearly was a great love there, a political unity there, and yet, as you pointed out, King would say things like, I don't want you to ever travel with me.
Yeah.
Were they political comrades? Did they really, what was their relation? I can't even imagine what their real relationship was like.
They certainly were political comrades. I think one of the things that Coretta doesn't get credit for is that she really had a, even before she met him, all the way back to Antioch College, a pretty broad based understanding and involvement of protest strategy, and particularly of nonviolence. She was actually led peace marches before he did. And there are several times in the wiretaps where he's complimenting the wording on some of her speeches. And I'm pleased. I didn't know Coretta was going to die, but I have a photograph in the photograph section of her at a peace march, kind of being jammed against the White House gates, trying to deliver a peace petition, and Dr. King's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So she, but you're right, he was, as his aide said, an old-fashioned chauvinist who thought she should stay at home, and that she had a political relationship to be, as they call it, the first lady of civil rights at a time when an extra bit of kind of regal dignity really did serve a political role, because black people's dignity was under assault every day, and it meant a lot to have somebody who carried herself the way Coretta did. It was no accident that she identified with Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah, no kidding. That's a good point. Well, I think let me end with a couple of thoughts. King, the nonviolent man who still was open to the understanding that worldwide he did not contemn the violence of the Viet Cong or the National Liberation Front. King, as the tormented man, but one of the people who had one of the highest introspective consciousnesses that I've ever seen reflected in this book. King, as trying very hard to reach out to white people, but having quite an anger at white people that he had to repress at times in the interest of what he thought was the best strategy, but was no fool about the fundamental racism of the majority, but a great appreciator of those minority whites who were willing to give their life for the movement. King is the internationalist who began in one of his last speeches to say, I think that black people in the United States need to see themselves as part of an anti-colonial revolution, and who picked up some of the progressive Anti-Colonial Alliances of W.E.B. Du Bois, King, who read and was very influenced by Black Reconstruction in America, which he pointed out was the last democratic opportunity and hope for the United States that he was trying to repeat. King, that was a person in transition who was grateful to Kennedy when he bailed him out of jail, tried to make his relationship with Johnson, but by 68, by the time he didn't necessarily run against Johnson, was a symbol of those who would run against Johnson and called for his defeat in the elections at that time. King, who was a great individualist with a big ego, welcome to many of us, but who had, in fact, within that, a tremendous sense of collectivity, an actual love for the poor, love for the black masses. And King, who came out of a particular culture of going to the cross and martyring himself, and the concept of the Christ martyr in the most progressive end, ends up being on the cross and ends up ending his life as a martyr. Taylor Branch, you'll have to challenge me next time if that was a good summary, but your book is excellent. We urge our listeners to read it at Canaan's Edge. I want to thank everybody. Now, if I can find my credits, Maggie LePeak. I want to thank Alan Lipsky. I want to thank Al Minsky. I want to thank Lisa Adler, the production assistant. And the music, you're going to just have to identify on your own. I was too deep into King's head. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us. Maybe we'll do this again.
Thank you for that last word. You did a very good summary. I appreciate it.
Okay, it's mutual.
Can't erase the sound. Can't erase the sound of 10 on 10, a drum, with a stroke of a pen. Drum, drum.